First case for argument, Addis versus LABR. Mr. Madden.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. Unlike many other employee protection statutes, the Energy Reorganization Act provides an independent, freestanding evidentiary framework, a framework that, by design, is intended to make those in the nuclear industry have a difficult time defending themselves. Heather Addis has petitioned this Court's review of the agency's decision in hopes that that framework will be honored.
Mr. Madden, my concern with the way you presented this case is really related to the standard of review, because if, hypothetically, summary judgment had been granted for the Department of Labor and Exelon, I could well imagine that you might have shown that there were disputed issues of fact about why Ms. Addis, however you want to phrase it, why her rescission of her resignation wasn't accepted. But this is not such a case. It's had a full hearing. We're here under the substantial evidence standard of review. And so the facts have now been weighed and resolved.
True.
Against your client.
It's certainly true that we've had a full evidentiary hearing. But I think even under the substantial evidence review standard, we wind up in the same place. And the first thing I would note to Your Honor is that the decision that we're asking to review, the Secretary adopted the ALJ's decision. The ALJ's decision called it a conclusion of law that plaintiff or Heather Addis did not meet the contributory factor standard. That was his conclusion of law. We're not asking the court really to reweigh disputed material pieces of evidence. We're saying take the evidence that the ALJ found and apply it to the statute 5851 that calls for a contributing factor standard.
But I think you are asking us to reweigh the evidence, because if you look at the evidence to the effect that there were concerns about her performance long before she ever raised her complaint, and those were precisely the reasons why Exelon chose not to, chose to let her go. Again, I'm trying to be fairly vague about that, because I know she submitted the letter of resignation, then she submitted her other letter saying she was rescinding, and I'm certainly willing to call that a termination if you want to for right now. But there were a lot of facts showing that all of the pieces of this puzzle were in place before she raised her complaint.
But the one fundamental piece of evidence that the ALJ doesn't address is that all of those things did not, by Exelon's own admission, did not warrant termination.
Well, they didn't, because, but then we come to this meeting of whenever it was, September the 28th or so, and I think a rational administrative agency could find that what Exelon expected was that perhaps she would go on a performance improvement plan, perhaps she would do something else. Instead, she submits a letter of resignation. She changes the course of events, not them.
Well, that's not strictly true, Judge. Glenn Morrow, the immediate supervisor with whom she had that discussion, says and testified that there was no immediate plan to do anything else other than to refer this issue out to the next level of management.
Right. And then she says, but I'm going to quit.
True. She does. And she rescinds that before anyone else talks to her.
On rescission, I've never seen a case like this in which someone quit and then brought an employment suit. So how do we analyze a case like this? Someone quits, and how do we analyze that?
As a straight termination case.
Apparently, person quits, goodbye. There's no duty to rehire, right?
I think we analyze this as a straight termination case, Judge. In fact, the Department of Labor says that...
The one thing that obviously is not is a straight termination case. Straight termination case, either person's fired, or conditions are made unbearable for the person. They have a constructive termination. But what is this case?
This case, the reason I say that we should analyze it as a straight termination case is because it is clear.
That's
it is
ridiculous.
Exelon's decision.
That's ridiculous. Look, it's not a strict termination case. She quit. Now, how do we analyze a case in which a person quits and then says, oh, I changed my mind? Now, we could think of it as a rehiring case. There's a hiring case, hiring discrimination. How should we think about it?
We think about it in terms of who is controlling the decision for her not to remain employed.
But wait a second, you're refusing to think about the case in its particulars. This is not a case about remaining employed. She severed the employment relationship when she quit. And my question for you is, should we therefore think of this as a case where, having quit, she then applies for reinstatement, and then we say, well, would they have reinstated someone else? Wouldn't that be the issue?
I don't think so, Judge. Again, because under 5851, we're showing that it's a contributing factor.
It's not a statutory question. It's a question about how do we treat this unusual situation, which could arise in any employment discrimination case, as I haven't seen it in 27 years, in which a person resigns and then complains about the refusal to honor her attempt to rescind the resignation.
The reason I bring up the statute, Judge, is because the adverse act there is any decision that the employer
makes. Okay, so what is
the
decision? Is it a failure to rehire her? Is that the decision?
Semantically, I'm not sure that it makes
a
difference.
Well, she didn't make... Oh, excuse me.
No, I'm sorry.
She didn't make her ECP complaint until after she'd given her letter.
Her initial letter of
her
intent to resign on the 10th of October. Yes.
And then she goes to the ECP after that.
She does. And in that,
so it's after resignation.
It is after her letter of resignation that says she intends to resign effective on October 10th. She turns it in on the 29th or the 1st. But before, and then she goes to the ECP. You're absolutely right about that, Judge. But before anyone has ever communicated, anyone from Exelon ever communicates with her at all about her letter of resignation or intent to resign, she submits the letter saying, I've changed my mind, I'm going to stay. And they allow her to continue to work for that 10-day period of time. They never discuss it with her at all. So what I'm asking the court to review is the action of the employer. And that's whether it's failure to rehire, whether it's failure to allow her to rescind the resignation, which had never been communicated as accepted to her. Ultimately, it's the employer's decision that discontinues the employment relationship. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Madden. Ms. Brenner?
Well, before I start to discuss the basis of the substantial evidence and the standard of review, I think I want to try to address your rescission question. As the ALJ found, that is an area that's not been very clear in the past. And so they treated her effort to rescind as part of the adverse action and didn't dispute it, and it wasn't separated as a separate action. The employer is entitled not to rescind. An employer can take any action it likes. It's entitled not to rescind an attempted rescission on an employee that's otherwise unsatisfactory, whose performance they are not happy with, and they don't particularly look forward to what they would have to do in the future, and therefore they go ahead and decide to accept the resignation and not to allow the rescission.
So, right, that was one thing I wanted to clarify. So it's the position of the Department of Labor that once that first letter comes in saying, I'm resigning,
correct,
then when the second letter comes in attempting to rescind the resignation, the employer has no duty to give any greater weight to the second letter than the first one.
That's correct. That's the Department of Labor's position. And whatever case law exists, and I think we cited a little bit to you, it's not terribly great, and it's not very and Judge Posner put his finger on it, the fact that this is analytically unusual, but the fact is that an employer can dismiss a person, an at-will employee, and is not under an obligation to accept a rescission or an attempted rescission. And this employer did not, for the very good and substantial evidence that existed of her unsatisfactory performance. I don't know if you need for me to review the nature of her unsatisfactory performance.
That's outlined in your brief.
In the brief, that's correct.
I mean, I think the question here really has to do with what it is we're looking at. I mean, in some ways, she's, of course, not in the general pool of people who aren't filing these evaluations of the others, because no one else, to my knowledge, in this record, submitted a letter of resignation.
Correct.
Other people were put on performance plans. I guess there wasn't very good compliance with this 80-20 rule.
Well, and others were even kept, and they didn't get around to it, if I understand the record correctly. Mm-hmm. But that's right. They were not. She was the only one that resigned.
So they basically now I suppose her strongest argument is that under this statutory standard, her complaint to the employee concerns program only had to play a very small role in the resignation. It didn't have to be a predominant role.
The statute says, the statute requires that after a hearing, her responsibility is to prove that it was a contributing factor. It doesn't have to be the main factor or a strong factor. It has to be a contributing factor. She did not. The only information that she tended to cite that would alert anybody to the fact that they were discussing this at the same time, and how could an employer not discuss this at the same time when it's all in the same timeline, doing it at the same time. Her only information is this equivocal statement made by the plant manager that when he was asked the question, would they take her back, he says he's not sure. Well, not sure isn't evidence. It's a statement. There's nothing to show that it had any impact whatsoever on their action, nor any of the other notes that were taken from those phone conversations. There was nothing to show that any of those had contributed in the slightest way. Everything in the substantial evidence shows that ECP claims complaints were welcomed, were reviewed, were thought well of, and were handled by the company without a bit of difficulty. If there's nothing else, I don't think that I need to add any further.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Brenner. Mr. Mendertsma?
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm representing the intervening respondent, Exelon Corporation. Because it's Election Day 2008 and we're going to hear all day long about votes and numbers, I want to start with the observation that this case before today has been presented to 21 different finders of fact or decision makers who have ruled 21-0 in Exelon's favor. And I know we don't count up all the votes in litigation over the course of litigation to see who wins, and that you three do have the final say in this matter. But it does bear remembering that, as this Court said in the Kahn case, which also arose under the Energy Reorganization Act, the touchstone of substantial evidence is whether there is such evidence as a reasonable mind might accept as adequate to support a conclusion. And I believe that the past litigation record in this case not only demonstrates that that Exelon's evidence is substantial, but it has been overwhelming and dispositive of the claim in this case. Because we had a case proceed through the Illinois court.
What's the difference between this standard and the ordinary Title VII standard?
In terms of the shifting burdens, or?
What I'm asking you, what is the difference? Is there any difference?
Yes, there is.
What is the difference?
Section 211 has two components on the burdens of proof, or the shifting burdens of proof, one of which deals with the pretrial stage and one of which deals with the trial stage. When you're at a trial stage, you don't follow the Title VII McDonnell-Douglas burden of proof scheme. You look at the text of Section 211.
You don't in Title VII either. Once you're in a trial, McDonnell-Douglas falls out completely. It's just about whether you can resist summary judgment.
I agree. In this case, in a 211 case, she bore the burden to prove retaliation. That means she had to prove that protected activity contributed to the adverse action, and that's laid out in the statute. I'm just making the point, you don't even look to Title VII case law to address this. Her brief keeps talking about the prima facie case, and that is not relevant at this stage of the game. I mean, the evidence has been weighed.
Please answer my question. So what is the difference between this standard under this act and the Title VII standard?
Title VII, if you're at the trial stage and you've exhausted the prima facie elements, requires proof that the gender or race or whatever was a motivating factor. Here, it's a contributing factor.
What on earth difference does that make?
Well,
what do those words mean?
I'm sure there's lots of different cases that talk about that. Contributing means it has to be one factor that contributed.
Oh, come on. That's the best you can do with contributory factor, a factor that contributes. That's a really helpful definition.
Well, that's...
That's the best you can do.
I believe that's... Yes, that's the best I can
and
do.
And a motivating factor, I suppose, is a factor that motivates.
It motivates, and that factor alone would have led to the decision. That had to be a motivating factor. I agree, it's, you know, Congress picked these words, I didn't pick the words, and I agree that there may be some fine lines there, but I don't think that Ms. Addis satisfied me.
I don't know what you're talking about, actually.
What do you mean?
You have not indicated any difference between the two statutes.
What difference would it make to your case if there were no difference between the two statutes?
It wouldn't make any difference. We would prevail under either
does
statute.
A contributing factor, contributory factor, whatever it is, does it have to be a but-for cause?
No, it does not. We don't take that position.
What sense does that make, right? Because if it's not even a but-for cause, it means there's no connection between the retaliation and the injury, right?
There could be cases where there are dual motives, where a manager...
No, but look, you can have a zillion motives, but the point is, if suppose she's a terrible worker, and she would have been fired, you know, regardless, and the retaliation, you know, didn't make a difference, made them angry, and it made the, you know, may have... thought that we have all this stuff against her, but even if they hadn't had the retaliatory motive or retaliatory contribution or whatever it is, they would have fired her anyway because of her bad work. Well, would she have a case?
It would shift the nature of the respondent's burden to be clear and convincing. That's what the difference would be.
What would you have to show by clear and convincing evidence?
That without the protected activity having occurred, the same decision would have been made.
Then it's a but-for cause. And then you said earlier it wasn't a but-for cause.
Well, the case law does not say it's a but-for cause, and I don't take that position. The Department of Labor hasn't taken the position.
Well, it doesn't mean anything then. You can't say it's not a but-for cause and just say that if it had, that even if there had been retaliatory motive, grounds, desire, what have you, she still would have been fired. Then it's not a but-for cause. You've defined contributory cause as a but-for cause. Anyway.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks very much. So, Mr. Madden, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Thank you.
Have some view on what the difference is between the two standards?
The difference, Judge, is contributory factors as any tendency at all to affect the outcome of the decision. If I think about...
Well, what if the decision would have been the same even if there hadn't been a retaliatory thought in the minds of the decision makers?
If the employer shows that by clear and convincing evidence, as opposed to the plaintiff showing by a preponderance of a contributing factor,
then
there's no relief. There's still a finding of liability under, you know, Part C, but there's no relief under Part D granted. So it's any factor that has any tendency at all. So if I think about how Your Honor broke down motivating factor in the Hassan case into those three different types of examples, it weighed so heavily on the mind, or it was a factor, case two was a factor that pushed it over the edge, or the third one, which was it was on their mind but weighed so lightly that it may not have impacted the decision.
And when you say a finding of liability without relief, would there be attorney's fees in a case like that?
I don't think so.
There's nothing.
I don't think so. The statute's a little strange in that regard because in Part D it says there's no relief unless there's no relief if the employer shows by clear and convincing evidence it would have done the same. And the relief is defined by Part 2 above, which includes all the equitable remedies, the reinstatement, the attorney's fees, and everything. So it's really a question of no relief. One point I'd like to address in Ms. Brenner's comments about the employer has no duty. In at will and situations, there never is a duty of the employer to continually retain the employee. So that really doesn't impact, and that's why I suggest that it really be analyzed as a straight termination case. The DOL in its brief, in fact, said that it considers it a straight termination case because there is no duty to retain an at-will employee. So, again, what we're looking at is who is really breaking off the employment relationship here. As of October 10th, everybody knew Heather Addis wanted to stay employed,
but
and
Mr.
she had been
Madden,
working that week.
I understand what you're saying, but the problem is, even looking at it as you're suggesting, as a straight termination case, you know, here's Exelon, they've got these two letters in front of them, they haven't said anything to her about either one. The package of facts that Exelon has that pertain to her employment is different from the package of facts it has vis-a-vis people who haven't sent a letter saying, I quit. So it seems to me wrong to say that the employer has to ignore the fact that these two letters have come in.
Well, I don't know that you're ignoring the fact of the letters.
I think you want them to. I think you're sort of saying it's just the same as if at that September 28th meeting the supervisor had said your work is unsatisfactory, you're fired, and it really isn't the same.
No, I'm simply suggesting that that question that Your Honor poses gets analyzed on the employer's burden of clear and convincing evidence, not on the contributory factor. Standard that the employee has to meet. In the words of Justice Story, leave off when done. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you very much to all three counsel. Next case for our